The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. We're going to take another crack at answering your questions. I think last week we got through quite a few. Quite a few for us means more than three. So don't want to get your hopes up too much, but we'll do our best to get more than three. That's our latest goal. We used to have these lofty goals of 8 or 9 questions, but almost all these questions end up having... And then there's this to think about and that to think about and, oh, don't forget about this aspect and those sorts of things. So if you're a longtime listener, you probably know that's what we're all about. We're not just going to give you the surface answer. We're going to kind of dive a little deeper into things than most people would on this topic of retirement planning, which is our kind of our niche. So thank you for joining us. Jim is rifling through the pile of questions. He hasn't yet told me what types of questions we have, but I would be willing to bet we have some Social Security questions. There's probably a question on an IRA here or there. Those are almost guaranteed. You're going to share with us what you have found?
Yeah, we're going to do exactly what you said, some Social Security questions, some IRA questions, and a hell of a lot of other questions if we can get to them. Okay. Any housekeeping measures? How was the FPA convention? I don't think you told our listeners that you went to the FPA convention.
Yeah, so
Financial Planning Association convention in sunny and warm Minneapolis.
For Minneapolis, it was sunny and warm. The first day was kind of cloudy, but the rest of the time it was sunny. The main thing I noticed, the breeze is colder. The moving air is colder. The sun was nice. The sun felt a lot like being here in Colorado and in the fall where... You know, but that breeze, if it got going, it was pretty chilly there. But, yeah, it could have been way worse. So we had decent weather, although in the convention, of course, you spend most of your time indoors. But I explored a little bit out into downtown Minneapolis within, you know, 3-block radius of the convention center. So I didn't get to see a lot of it. I've been there a couple times. But, yeah, it was good. It was set in on several... presentations related to what we do. There was a nice presentation by Wade Fow, who talked a lot about the benefits of having what he calls buffer assets so that you can control, you can kind of protect yourself from what we talk about on the show quite a lot is sequential risk. So the most treacherous time in retirement are the early years, those first 10 years of retirement. Depending on how your assets hold up during that 10-year period, really kind of sets almost in stone your ultimate trajectory through the rest of your retirement. So he's a big proponent of buffer assets, and he's got a variety of things he talks about in that regard. So I listened to that. It wasn't earth shattering.
I go usually 15, not 10, like he does. I do the first 15 years.
Yeah.
That so. I personally think is the most risky.
Yeah.
I think people can live 30 years, especially a lot of our clients. They're retiring in their late 50s, early 60s.
For sure.
Yeah.
But those, you know, as you and I have talked about before, those early years, if you have a bad series of returns,
oh, absolutely,
your assets, it
absolutely
can devastate what you're doing. So you got to build some protections.
Absolutely. The protections and the, that. I mm-hmm. usually say, mm-hmm. I know Wade espouses the first 10 years of mm-hmm. retirement. That's, mm-hmm. to me, too short. I think you should protect mm-hmm. the first 15 years, or at least recognize the first 15 years are risky. Mm-hmm. Later in life, who is it? Kitsis also espouses that an 85, 90-year-old theoretically or academically can afford a 50% drop in their portfolio, but a 60-year-old can't.
Right.
And you would think it's the other way around, but it all comes down to life expectancy.
Right. So that was decent. There wasn't anything really new other than he was talking about his new book that was out. So I just bought it.
I
pulled the trigger. I haven't read it. It shows up actually today. It'll be waiting for me at home when I get there.
See, I did it through this thing called Kindle. I got it instantly.
Yeah, that's very advanced for you. I've had a Kindle before, and I never really got in. I don't like reading it that way.
Oh, see, I do it on the app on my iPad, the Kindle app.
Yeah.
And I much prefer it.
See, I like to have the book, and then I can scribble things in there.
You can scribble in Kindle. You can highlight. You can actually click a word if you don't know the meaning or how to pronounce it. If you don't know how to pronounce it, you click it, and you click pronounce, and it'll say what the word is. That's very helpful for me. And also with words I don't know, it will give you the definition. And when I was reading a book on World War II from the German side, which is a very interesting book, and it was written by a German soldier, obviously. Mm-hmm. He wrote a lot in German, not in the whole book. The whole book was transcribed into English, but some phrases were left in German. It will...
translate that
Thank
for you.
I was going to say dictate, but it mm-hmm. translated it into English for me.
Maybe I'll give the Kindle... maybe I'll try it again. I had an early Kindle that didn't do all those fancy things.
Yeah, so. Well, I have the app on the iPad. Mm-hmm. I was like you. I would never... Well, geez, you know me. Mr. Tech, come on. I still print out emails. I mean, look at my table here. People probably think we're making this up. No, there's literally printed emails all on my table. But for reading, I got out of the book. It's all in the Kindle now.
Okay.
So, well, anyways...
This time I'm going to read the book, because I already ordered the book.
You get the book.
The more interesting one that, again, aligns with a lot of what we do and talk about on the show is... Dr. Richtenstein from Baylor. He's been a researcher and publisher in the retirement planning space for a very, very long period of time, very well known. And he did a over-hour presentation on tax-optimized distributions and how paying attention to where you pull money from and or converting from pre-tax to post-tax accounts, Roth conversions, how consciously doing those things and paying attention to when and where to withdraw money from different accounts can really change your overall ability to spend in retirement because of the management of taxes. And we do a lot of that work here. And again, a lot of what he was presenting academically are things that we've been putting into practice for a period of time, but it's always good for him to see kind of an in-depth analysis. And he ran through kind of five different test case people that could benefit from.
And were you sitting there thinking, wow, this is all new? Or were you sitting there thinking, wow, this is good. This is what we do. I don't know. I haven't talked to you yet about this. So how did
it was mostly, wow, this is, you know, I'm glad that people are doing a lot more of the research into that is turning out to support the approaches that we've been taking for quite some time. So it's...
That's what I've been saying, that academics mm-hmm. are finally catching up to the reality. One that's catching up is what we keep trying to get people to understand. You are going to spend more on fun things earlier in life. And the quote-unquote 4% safe withdrawal rule unnecessarily constrains a lot of spending
yep.
on fun things.
Right. But you can't just go ratchet that up to a higher percentage without any other considerations or modifications, because then you know, as you increase your withdrawal percentage from your assets. So let's say you're taking this the Benjamin approach, right, where you're going to just take a certain percentage of your assets out every year, and that's your retirement plan. You read somewhere that taking out 3.5-4% per year was quote unquote safe. You know, not my words, but theirs. You just trudge along, but then you realize what you just mentioned, that really constrains. You'd like to spend more early on, and you don't feel like you can under this rule, so you ratchet it up to 8, 9, 10%. Well, now you do absolutely increase the risk of running out of money. So you need to take other steps. You know, on one hand, if you increase the early withdrawals, you need to do something on the other hand. And in our world, the other something is to provide protections for your most critical expenses, what we call your minimum dignity floor expenses. You protect those, then you can feel more comfortable ratcheting up early on because you have created kind of a safety net or base level of protection via lifetime secure income. So that's our balance, right? You can't just turn up the one dial.
Did Rickenstein, whatever his name is.
We had a conversation at lunch. It should be Reichenstein.
Oh, it's Reichenstein.
Well, it should be, but his great-grandfather changed it when he was here in the United States to Rickenstein, because I think, you know, they didn't want to sound like Nazi Germany. So
he tricked me. I didn't think it was German at all.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's Rickenstein officially.
But in his espousing, mm-hmm. what did he encourage planners to help clients separate, for lack of a better term, what we call them minimum dignity floor expenses and go-go, slow-go, no-go fund spending? Was he suggesting we separate them? And was he suggesting that what we call the minimum dignity floor, those groups of expenses that will continue forever and you cannot run out of money on those, did he suggest covering them with guaranteed income like we do, pension, Social Security, income annuity? Or was he taking a withdrawal-first approach? What was his? Granted, it's one thing to say, yeah, you got to protect the first 10 years of retirement.
That was Wade Fowle.
Oh, Wade Fowle. Granted, you've got to optimize your taxes. That's one thing. Was he only concentrating on the tax aspect? Or was he looking at the way we do everything?
It was mostly the tax aspects of it. Okay. So what we do is really a blend, I would say, between... And actually, Wade Fowle has released papers on different approaches. He's not really... Although I would say he's leaning towards picking our approach more as his favorite, if you read what he's been doing lately.
I think he's stealing ideas from us.
Maybe. But he's, you know, he did a book recently on just withdrawal funding of, you know, not doing secure income, not even thinking about that,
right.
Managing withdrawals.
That was his book one. Book
right.
two was the reverse right. mortgages. Book right. three is his buffer.
Right. So I think his book three approach, which most closely aligns, not perfectly, but closely aligns with our approach, I think it's becoming his favorite. But that maybe he's just good at selling his current idea. I don't know. Rickenstein approach, he doesn't really focus on that aspect of it. It's more on the tax optimization piece, which we've, for years espoused as an important piece to look at that is under-focused upon by people in retirement. They focus so much on other things and ignore decisions that affect taxes.
Or they just delay.
Right.
Their 401k as long as possible.
So what we do is kind of a blend of those. The software that Rickenstein puts out there doesn't quite have our level of detail on the expenses, separating them out, minimum dignity floor. But I happened to talk to him at lunch, and he seemed interested in the idea. So... he took some notes in his, he calls it his Palm Pilot. It was a little notepad, kind of like what you use. Where's your iPad? I don't think you brought it up.
Oh, keep talking.
So those are the two main presentations I went to. There's been a lot of improvements in what we call fintech, so financial technology, so a lot of new software programs, etc., and more are starting to accommodate some of the level of detailed analysis that we do here. So we've had to, over the years, do some kind of one-off additions or supplements to the commercially available software that's available for retirement planning purposes. And more of what we were doing custom one-off is now being embedded into these new software programs. So that's encouraging. It'd be nice if we didn't have to do these one-off custom deals, because whenever you do that, it's, you know, added time and cost and that sort of thing. So having it all more automated is beneficial to everybody. And what else did I run across when we were there? Students. I took a group of students out there with us, and they had a lot of opportunity to network with people. A lot of planners out there are looking for new young talent. So that's one of the reasons why we take these students to these conferences, is educational and future career opportunities. Something that Wade Fow did just talk about, and while Jim's sitting down, I'll share with some kind of updated statistics about longevity. So this is another tidbit that picked up that, so a 65-year-old female nowadays in the United States has an 11% chance of living to be over 100.
Wow.
Which is not tiny. I mean, it is, which means 90% aren't, but still 10% is a pretty large number.
11.
Okay, I rounded. But yes, 11, Jim. A 31% chance of living to 95. So that's close to a third, right? Males, you might think, well, yeah, they all die off early. Males reaching 65 have a 22% chance of living to 95.
How much of a chance do we have to live to 100?
I think it's so low that he didn't...
Snowball
in
hell?
He didn't talk about that one, but I think it's very low. Anyway, but here's the one that's the kicker for most people. A 65-year-old couple, there's a 46% chance, almost a 50% chance, that one will live to 95.
Well, we know it's going to be the woman.
Well, not necessarily. The woman only has a 31% chance. That extra 15% comes from the combined longevity statistics of the couple, and it's the male pushing it out there.
Gotcha.
So give them a little credit, right?
Well, when we
now, these are traditional male-female relationships. Obviously, if it's a same-sex couple, these stats are going to be different. But
now, if a male identifies as a female, does his chances of living to 95 jump to 31?
Well, I think you'd see a lot more males identifying in such a way if that's what happened.
Okay.
I think it's more complicated than that.
A little more complicated?
I think it's a little more complicated than that.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you can't just identify as a female and get the longer life expectancy.
You can't elect, right. I would, you know, hold up your hand. I elect to live longer.
Just wondering. Nice. These are the things running through my mind.
Yeah, no, I get
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to ask, because you've been in all day, but as always...
Getting caught up on stuff.
Yeah, I haven't had it. You and I, this is literally the first time we really got to sit and chat about things. So welcome home. And we should jump into questions, since you wanted to get through 14 of them today.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay. We'll start with a Social Security one. I had it right here. Okay, right here. Mm-hmm. This one you reached out to the gentleman on personally, so I know you're going to be able to answer it.
Well, hopefully I remember. Was it recent?
Yeah, a little over a month ago.
Oh, okay.
Okay. He was from Georgia. We'll call him George from Georgia.
Well, again, may or may not be from Georgia, because George and Georgia are the... Right. Mm-hmm.
State of residence, Georgia.
I know, but we've had this conversation, Jim. They pick that when they want to be completely anonymous, because it has George in it.
Oh, got you. So pulling a fast one.
Right. They might be from Georgia. Might not.
All right. This George from who knows where... is, I'm going to guess, a financial planner, or at least someone that has to do with clients, because he writes, I have a client that was married 9 years and 10 months to her ex. Is the 10-year rule counted by months, literally, or by calendar years? Do you want me to read your answer?
No, I remember this one. So the 10-year rule, you have to reach your 10th anniversary. And it's a cliff. It's a cutoff. You have to reach that day. You have to celebrate your 10th anniversary from the day you were married in order to meet the 10-year rule. So it is annual. And 9 years and 10 months, unfortunately, doesn't quite make it. Whoever, you said they were divorced? after 9 years.
I didn't
and 10
say anything.
Months,
I just read. I just read the guy's email.
Yeah, if
they were married for 9 years and 10 months to her ex, so I'm assuming they
divorced.
Were married.
So the client should have had a better lawyer because delaying that extra 2 months unlocks the door to.
Why don't you explain
benefits.
What this 10-year rule is? So we're talking. Mm-hmm. A lot of new listeners won't know what the hell it is you're talking about.
So the Social Security system has a rule that if you were married for 10 years, even if you get divorced, you still have the rights in claiming Social Security benefits of a spouse. And actually slightly more, I'm not going to go into all the detail, but slightly more liberal benefits. There's a couple rules that apply to married spouses that actually fall by the wayside when you are divorced, but they decided people that are in long-term divorces, just because someone got divorced, and traditionally it was the stay-at-home spouse that wore maybe that didn't work very, raised kids and things like that. It was very unfair to them in a divorce. They get left behind. The higher earning, the wage earner, the breadwinner, keeps their big old Social Security benefit. But with the divorce, the other spouse really was harmed financially. So they came out with this rule that not everybody, but as long as you were married for 10 years, you get to claim spousal benefits like you were still married. And even if your ex remarried, all the spouses get benefits. So it doesn't take away from anyone's benefit. A lot of people misunderstand how Social Security works and thinks that a spouse or survivor benefit takes away from someone else. It doesn't. It's you either have earned it or not. It only affects you for the most part. And so that's why people are worried about staying married for 10 years. And here, unfortunately, married 9 years and 10 months, just 60 days roughly away from keeping a lifetime opportunity of claiming spousal benefits from the ex-spouse's record. So the question was, is this really true? And it is true that it's a hard 10 years. You have to make it to the 10th anniversary of your marriage. I suggested a couple of Hail Marys, I believe, in my email back to this person. The Hail Mary, I know one of them was, check the state in which they resided and double check and see if by chance they could have been legally considered married prior to their wedding date due to maybe a common law marriage circumstance. There are states, Colorado being one of them, that have very
liberal
is probably the word again, definitions of common law marriage. And if you could make the case that they were really married for more than 10 years because of a technicality like this, that might open the door then
and
to spousal benefits.
And Social Security does honor common law marriage.
They do. They do. So that's why I pointed it out. This is something, it is a Hail Mary. And then there was, I thought I gave him two things.
I think
the other was to recount, just make absolutely sure.
Yeah, triple check the anniversary against the actual divorce decree.
Yeah, so it could be it's when the divorce decree, when you officially become divorced, it's not when you file for divorce. That's just the beginning of the process. The official divorce will be a court decided date and, hopefully then they'll find on a technicality that the client squeaked in. But it is a hard and fast reach your 10th anniversary rule on the 10-year rule.
Okay. All right. This one is a quick Social Security question. I have a feeling we might have answered this one, but you had said a couple weeks ago you didn't think we did, so we're going to answer it again.
Okay.
This is from another George, this time from Florida, but we will call him George.
I have more confidence in that. Because they wouldn't have picked Florida randomly. It doesn't.
So you feel he's really from Florida?
I think so.
All right. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. If the stretch IRA goes away, will this affect annuities that are held inside an IRA?
You said another Social Security question.
Did I say that?
Yes.
I misspoke.
Okay. I'm thinking, boy, this is a strange beginning to a Social Security question.
The next one is a Social Security question.
Okay.
Well,
no problem.
We got other Social Security. Okay. We got a lot. But anyway,
so
I thought I said an annuity question, no?
No.
All right. Anyways, I remember talking to you about this question a couple of weeks ago, and I thought we answered it. You thought we didn't, so we're going to readdress it. If we have already answered this in the past, because this email came in a long time ago.
People have probably forgotten.
Yeah, if we did answer it in the past, sorry, we're doing it again. The IRA folks, takes precedent over the annuity. The IRA takes precedent over anything you put inside it. You could put a house inside it, and the rules of a house no longer apply. Capital gains or anything like that. The rules of the IRA take over. So if the stretch IRA goes the way of the dodo bird, which it may under the SECURE Act, if it ever makes its way through the Senate, the House passed it unanimously. Did I get that?
You did.
Thank you. I nailed it. The House passed it. Well, I don't want to say unanimously because I think 9 people voted against it, so that really wasn't unanimous.
Yeah. Overwhelmingly.
Overwhelmingly. Much easier word to say as well. So the House passed it overwhelmingly, but it kind of died in the Senate. But part of that bill this year was to abolish the stretch IRA and replace it with either a 5-year or 10-year payout. The House version had 5 years. The Senate version had 10. And it would apply to non-spouse beneficiaries. Spouses would be able to continue to treat a retirement account as their own. It would not apply to minor beneficiaries until they reached the age of majority. So something to look forward to.
So a really young child could still stretch is what that means.
Until they reach the age of majority. Right. And there was disabled people as well.
So a few exceptions.
There was one other exception. I can't remember which one it was. But the rule hasn't passed. But if it does pass, it doesn't matter if you have an annuity inside your IRA, a chunk of gold, of a house. You can own everything inside an IRA except life insurance and collectibles. Very good. Right on top of things.
It was coming out.
When I point to you, that's your cue. You weren't looking.
I was looking to see who was listening.
Yeah, I know. I got you off to the side, not paying attention. Life insurance and collectibles are really the only two items you can't own inside an IRA. But the IRA rules will take over. It doesn't matter what you have in there. So, yes, you will have to close the IRA. Now, does he have to get rid of the annuity?
Get rid of the annuity?
Well, he has it. I'm going to guess this particular George has an annuity inside an IRA. Mm-hmm. He's worried that if he dies, and I'm guessing a non-spouse beneficiary inherits it, and they're going to have to close it within 5 to 10 years and take all the money out of the IRA and pay taxes on it. Does the person who inherited the IRA actually have to get rid of, sell, liquidate, whatever you want to say, and distribute cash from said IRA?
No.
Exactly. So even if, listener, the stretch goes away and you have to close, and the rule is going to be no IMDs at all, the account just has to be emptied within 5 or 10 years.
Right.
So if it's a 10-year rule, from year 1 through 9, you can take nothing out, but you got to take it all out in year 10. No IMDs anymore for non-spouse beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. You just have to close it all and pay taxes on the distribution within the 10-year period. Right.
But you have some flexibility during that time to choose how much comes out each year.
You could take out a little or a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So your beneficiary could, if the annuity is really good, let's say you bought it years ago and it has a high guaranteed interest rate and you don't want to lose that and you want your beneficiaries to have that, the insurance company may, you have to check with them, they may not allow the beneficiary to continue the annuity. But if they let the beneficiary continue the annuity, distribute the annuity out. You don't have to sell it. You just tell the IRA custodian, it could be the insurance company directly, or it could be an independent third-party custodian, distribute the actual annuity. Just get it out of the wrapper of the IRA. And also what that means, folks, they're going to give you probably a new account number because it's no longer inside the IRA, and you're going to get a big fat 1099. That's it. The annuity is still there. It's not being sold. It's just being distributed out. Now, some custodians don't have the ability to do that, or some insurance companies may not want or allow you to do that, especially, Chris, if it's paying a very high interest rate from the 80s or the 90s or even the early 2000s. No, they might say, nope, the annuity has to be closed. We're not honoring that 5, 6, 7% guaranteed interest rate anymore. Those annuities do exist, folks. They were sold all throughout the 80s and 90s. Now, not too many people have them anymore, but if you did and it happens to be inside an IRA and the stretch goes away, you have to really have the beneficiary check with the IRA custodian and find out if they will allow the policy to be paid out, not sold. Just transferred out, 1099 issued. You got to pay taxes on it, but the policy still exists. The bigger risk to you, listener, isn't going to be the death of the stretch if you really like the IRA annuity. It is, will the insurance company allow a non-spouse beneficiary to continue with the annuity? Many don't. Many will let the spouse continue under what is known as spousal continuation. But they don't let the annuity continue beyond that.
Right.
And the IRS itself, goodness, I totally forgot that part. The IRS itself, when a non-spouse beneficiary inherits an annuity, often requires that annuity to be annuitized within 1 year or fully liquidated within 5 years. So even if the stretch IRA doesn't go the way of the dodo bird, you may still be forced, or the beneficiary, non-spouse beneficiary, may still be forced to close the annuity. Now, if the annuity is in the IRA wrapper and the insurance company is forcing the non-spouse beneficiary to close it within 5 years, they can close that, transfer it, not to their own IRA, but to an inherited IRA, and delay the taxes, but you may still be forced to close the annuity within
pretty
5 years.
Right.
Just remember, listener, the IRA is like a vessel. It's just it's a glass jar or a bucket or a Tupperware. Tupperware, I like that one better. It's a piece of Tupperware. What you put in is the annuity. But they're two separate things. You can shake that IRA Tupperware and the annuity will rattle inside it. They're not connected. They're two separate entities. It's just that the Tupperware, or in this case the IRA, their rules take precedence on what's inside. Like that analogy, huh?
Kind of. I prefer Rubbermaid.
Oh. You don't like Tupperware?
No.
Okay. Do you still have to go to Tupperware parties to get Tupperware? Or is it
I don't think you have
now?
To, but that used to be the way. My mom had a couple Tupperware parties.
Remember the little Tupperware burp?
I loved the burp. But yeah, I think I prefer Rubbermaid.
Okay.
For the dollar.
All right. Next
just
question.
Just a personal preference.
Next question. This one is from a Tennesseean.
A volunteer?
Guess so, Tennessee mm-hmm. Volunteers. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a two-part question. Mm-hmm. It is from a woman who gave her real name, but we're going to call her Georgette from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. She said, and I guess this is hypothetical, because it doesn't say that she has it. She just says, if you had $1.7 million in a traditional IRA and just $120,000 in a Roth, would you be pumping all your extra money directly into the Roth, or would you use it for a Roth conversion? And then she writes, I need to contribute 6% each year to my 401k to get the employer match, but I'm currently contributing 13, and I wonder if I should put the extra 7 and keep it out and use it to help pay taxes on Roth conversions instead. That's her first question, kind of a planning question there. Mm-hmm. Her second question is, why on hell would you retire and move to Kentucky where you will pay five, and she didn't put hell, I put that part in. She says, why would you retire and move to Kentucky, she must be talking to you, where you will pay 5% state income tax when you could retire just slightly more to the south, to the beautiful state of Tennessee, where our income taxes are zero, nada, none, zilch.
She has a good point.
Because I would never live in Tennessee. I have nothing against it. It's freaking hotter than heck down there. You think Kentucky
touching.
Is hot? Yeah, but I won't be in. I will be in the northern part of Kentucky.
It's not that much different, I don't think. It's darn hot in the north part, too.
The north part is just south of Ohio.
Yeah. It's hot.
Ohio's not hot. I mean, it's hot.
Have you visited
summer.
Any of these places?
No, never.
I know.
But, well, when I think, oh, gee, it's winter. Let's go someplace warm. What are the flights to Ohio costing? Have you
I'm
ever
not saying
heard
it's hot
that?
All year long. It's icy, cold, humid ice storms in the winter, and it's jungle hot in the summer.
Anyways, listener, thank you for your pulling for the state of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. A few clients of ours has moved.
If it were me considering Kentucky, I definitely would also consider Tennessee, if that makes her feel better. I wouldn't discriminate.
I love fall and winter. I really do. And I like winters.
You don't think Tennessee has fall and winter?
Tennessee does not get cold in the winter. If it does, it's like for a day.
No,
it's Tennessee.
True.
Tennessee's the South. Hell, they were a Confederate state. They fought for the South.
They didn't fight for the North.
Ohio fought for the North.
That doesn't determine the weather pattern, though.
I'm just saying, listener, I do appreciate it. 5% state income tax savings isn't enough for me to give up cool fall weather and winter weather. I do enjoy that. So, back to her questions.
Yes.
This, folks, comes down to what Chris and I espouse a lot on the show. Tax diversification, that's mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. But also, what is the cost of getting money into a Roth now? What is the tax savings of getting money into a non-Roth now? And what would it cost to get money into a Roth later? And what will your taxes be later? Mm-hmm. That's really what she needs to determine. Mm-hmm. If the numbers she gives in fact reflects her, and she didn't say yes or no, they did or they didn't, but if she has $1.7 million in IRA and 401k assets and just $120,000 in Roth assets, we call IRA assets always taxable assets. We call Roths never taxable assets. And we call a brokerage or bank account a maybe taxable asset. And what Chris and I encourage our listeners to pay attention to is tax diversification, because it's going to give you flexibility. It's going to give you the ability to do planning decisions, decide, this year, can I take money out of always taxable accounts, maybe taxable accounts, never taxable accounts? Is there a way to get maybe taxable accounts, which are, again, are bank and brokerage accounts generally subject to capital gains? Can I get that in any given year out tax-free because of the way the capital gains rules work? So we like tax diversification. She doesn't seem to have very good tax diversification.
Correct.
Now, we don't know what she has in maybe taxable. She never indicated anything. She just said $1.7 million in traditional, which we call always taxable, and $120,000 in never Roth. She doesn't give me any hint. She does say her age is 56. She doesn't give me any hint on what her tax bracket is right now. She says she's saving 6% to get a 6% match. She's putting in 13 total. So would she be better off, Chris, she wonders, taking that extra 7% as pay and not putting it in her her 401k, and using that money every year to pay the taxes on a conversion? We can't answer that for her specifically, but I'm not convinced. Based on the dollar amount she's talking, you don't amass $1.7 million in IRA and 401k assets being a lower-waged earner. So I'm just going to assume she's making several hundred thousand dollars a year. I could be totally wrong, but I'm guessing that. And if she is, granted, her RMDs at age 70 are going to be quite large. But there'll probably be a period of time. I don't want to read too much into this. She didn't indicate when she wants to retire, Chris. But if she retires in her 60s, there may be a period of time where she could manipulate some income and start getting money out of her 401k and IRAs in lower brackets than it would have cost her right now to put it in a Roth. But we'd need to really crunch those numbers. What do you think? I don't think we could just blatantly say do this or
can't
do that.
Answer, but there's a few things I'd like to say. One, don't dismiss the potential benefits of doing Roth conversions while still working. Not for everybody, but a lot of people think, that couldn't possibly be a good idea. I'm making all this money, la, la, la. There's actually plenty of cases where if you look at it, it can make perfect sense to do conversions even while still working. That being said, then there's a period after work that you might have a great potential to do Roth conversions. And then that might lessen. A lot of times people think they must stop or they should stop doing Roth conversions after they reach 70.5 and RMDs start. Again, just like you shouldn't dismiss it while you're working, don't dismiss out of hand the potential benefits of doing additional Roth conversions after 70.5. It can make perfect sense, especially when you look at all the extra taxes that the government is starting to place upon people. They're not calling them taxes, but they're effectively taxes in the case of, in particular, higher Medicare premiums. It is possible for you to maybe force a lot of income to be recognized over a short period to then avoid maybe a decade or more of not just taxes and tax consequences directly in income tax, but also IRMA, the Medicare subsidy or the Medicare premiums that can be very substantial if you have lots of modified adjusted gross income. So I think I applaud her for considering it. She definitely should consider it. Whether she should or not is going to come down to when she plans to retire, what her current earnings are, what her projected needs are for distributions and other brokerage accounts she might have. You know, there's too many variables, bottom line, for us to just say, oh, yeah, you should go out and do this. But I know a lot of people were hearing this thinking, oh, no, she shouldn't consider doing a Roth conversion while she's still working. She should wait till she retires. Not always. It can sometimes make perfect sense, but you've got to have decent tax forecasting software, tax optimization software, ideally, that can kind of look at your situation, what your planned distributions and savings are over the coming years, and then show you what doing different things with your surplus she really has. She's saving. She's not spending all of her income. She's saving a substantial portion of it, 13%, right? So, yes, I agree we can't answer this, but I wanted to point out, don't dismiss pre-retirement and post-70.5 conversions as possibilities, because they absolutely can make sense sometimes.
Absolutely, but what I'm thinking in her case, it may show, an analysis may show, Chris, she should be maxing out her pre-tax now, because I have a feeling she might be in a higher bracket. And then depending on your tax diversification, and if you do have maybe taxable assets, my strategy will definitely take some maybe taxable bank and brokerage assets. Max out. Let's just say you're in the 32% bracket right now, or the 30, 32, or 33, whatever they are. It's 32 now. If you're in that bracket, or even the 28 bracket, do they have the 28 or the 28 become the 32?
No, there's 28 and 24.
Just 24, 28. Okay. So if you're in the 28 or 32 bracket now, maybe it would behoove you to save in the pre-tax account and get a rebate, if you will, of $280 or $320 for every $1,000 you put into your 401k. Maybe even mentally account for that and squirrel that money away if you want. But when you retire, if you have substantial, maybe taxable assets that can help fund the beginning phase of your retirement and you keep your tax brackets low, you can start filling the 10 and the 12, or it'll be 15 by then probably, the 15 and the 24. 25. Is that what it's going to? I'm trying to remember the old brackets. The 25 bracket, you can start filling those brackets, 10, 15, and 25. We're talking as if the Trump tax cuts expire in January of 2026, like they're scheduled to. That's why we're using the older brackets. But you may be able to start filling with Roth conversions. And remember, if you amass $20,000 to pay taxes through this savings that I'm talking about doing, you took the tax savings of putting money in the 401k now and you start squirreling it away, $20,000, Chris, may convert $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 of assets later if you just fill those lower brackets first with them and apply your standard deduction, and by then the personal exemption will be back. Start applying all of that to the conversion money, but that strategy that I'm sharing with you, listener, will take ample, maybe taxable assets. So don't overlook... Let me change that. Instead of don't overlook, she hasn't overlooked anything. She emailed us. Crunch the numbers. This isn't something that I or Chris or any other financial podcast prognosticator is going to be able to answer for you, or even radio show host. They need to crunch numbers. And you can probably do this. You got to start projecting at the level you're saving. What are your taxes going to be before you retire? What are they going to be between retirement and RMDs? And what are they going to be post-RMDs? You got to make those projections so you can start comparing the three and deciding. I'm not convinced, Chris, she should be saving in a Roth right now. That's the thing. I'm not convinced.
Even though she has little tax diversification, it might be hard to justify now, depending on her current, her other income sources. Absolutely. I think it's low, but don't dismiss it. Depending on her specific circumstances, and I disagree. You could have $1.7 million without making $200,000-$300,000 a year, especially if you have you inherited one from your spouse.
Well, it's all inside an IRA or granted, she could have inherited. Right. You're right.
So we don't know enough.
There's not enough here. Yeah. Another thing you can do, listener, is we do record these every Monday around 1:30 Mountain Time, and you can listen live, but call in the show. You would call in our office. The number's on our website. Go to Jim Helps. That's Jim, J-I-M-H-E-L-P-S, jimhelps.com. Mondays at 1:30 Mountain Time, 1:30 in the afternoon. That's usually around the time we start recording. You can stream live right from the homepage. You can hear the show as we record it. But you could also call in and share with us a little bit more information that we don't know, and we might be able to give you a little bit more specificity. But I like your train of thought. I'm just not certain yet. And remember what Chris was mentioning earlier, listeners, with that Richterstein fella. It's about taxes. And in order to do taxes, you have to do projections, and you have to look at what if I did nothing? What if I did nothing proactive? What would this look like? And then what if I did this? What if I did that? And you got to compare everything to the baseline. This is the track you're on if you do nothing. And then here are some strategies to reduce what will happen to you if you continue to do nothing. I'm just not convinced yet, Georgette, if you should be saving into a traditional or a Roth. I just don't have enough info of what your situation is going to be. And then again, I do appreciate your shilling for the fine state of Tennessee. I'm just not sure there's enough winter in Tennessee. And I have a feeling there'll be too much summer in Tennessee and not enough winter. I'm looking for more winter, less summer. And not like cold, cold-ass winter. I'm done with that. But
So no Minnesota?
No, Minnesota's out of the picture. Could not go there. Mm-hmm. No. Okay, next question.
Hawaii has a very temperate climate. You just have to get two houses. One, you could go to Alaska and go fishing and get your cool weather up there and then get your not too hot, but you can grow lots of stuff weather
in
the rest
Hawaii?
Of the time of the year. Yeah.
Nah. I'm not a Hawaii kind of guy.
Have you ever been there?
Never.
You have a lot of judgments about places without ever having been there. Just saying.
Okay. Here's another Social Security question for you, my good friend. He is an Illinoisian, and we will call him, as always, George. He begins, hello. It's a nice way to begin. Hello. I'm considering getting married. Well, you want to talk him out of that, or are you going to...
Maybe. We'll see how this this conversation goes. I'm a huge fan of my current marriage.
Okay.
Just saying. Just putting that out there right now.
Yeah. You're pro-marriage. I'm questionable on marriage.
Again, you haven't ever lived it, right?
No, I've
Here's
never
another
been
case where you've never been there.
But that's because I need someone to marry. And that has
true.
Proven to be a problem.
Clearly.
Yeah. We're searching. I can't meet a woman to save my life. I'll have to tell you about the singles event I went to last Friday when you weren't here.
We could start a third podcast for those types of things. We could.
How to pick up women?
How Jim tries to pick up women.
You figure going to a singles event, I'd have a pretty good chance.
One would think.
Didn't work out
no?
that way.
Okay.
Begins, hello. I'm considering getting married. I'm 64 years old and a widower. So he's done it before, so he knows what he's doing. I am a 64-year-old widower and receive monthly Social Security benefits from a lifetime of hard work. Well, good for him. I'm grateful, but if I remarry, will it reduce my benefits?
Nope.
Will you let me finish the question?
Sure, go ahead.
My future wife...
He seems like he's really searching for reasons not to get married. Just putting that out there now, right now.
Listener, that is coming from this horse's mouth, not mine. I would marry at the drop of a hat right now. And if you believe that, I have some oceanside property in Arizona I want to sell you. Okay, hello. Can I begin again? I am considering getting married. I'm a 64-year-old widower and receive monthly regular Social Security benefits from a lifetime of hard work. I'm very grateful. If I remarry, though, will it reduce my benefits? My future wife never paid into Social Security and currently doesn't collect. She does plan on keeping working after we get married. That's all he said.
Well, let me clarify what I said. When I said his benefit wouldn't go down, no. But in my experience, when you get married, the benefits and income you have coming in get spent more aggressively with a spouse compared to no spouse. So just putting that out there. So no, the benefit won't go down. And in fact, in this case, there'll be a net improvement because 12 months after you get married, you have to be married for 12 months before you can collect spousal benefits. Your spouse will then be eligible to collect a spousal benefit on your record, which if they do so, does not reduce your benefit at all. The spousal benefit will be paid and depending on the age of your spouse. I don't think he shared that with us. He was 64. I don't know the age of the spouse. If the age of the spouse is, if the spouse has reached their full retirement age, they'll be eligible to receive half of your full retirement age benefit, which you're collecting now at 64, which is early. So you actually have a reduced benefit. So your spouse could actually receive more than half of what you are collecting now. So some people think it's only half of what a person's collecting. It's actually half of a person's PIA, primary insurance amount, which is the full retirement age benefit. Just because you claim early does not reduce your spouse's benefit if they claim on your record. Your spouse's age determines the limitation on the spousal benefit. So I can't tell you exactly how much they would get, but it's just additional income or benefit for the household, assuming you're planning to live together as a married couple, which is traditional. So yeah, it's a net benefit financially in this particular case as far as the Social Security benefit goes. The other thing right now, if you were to pass away not being married, your significant other, we'll call them before you're married, gets nothing. Gets nothing. Where if you were married for just 9 months, so here again,
unless
Social
he dies
Security
in an accident.
Would you give me a second?
I beat you.
That's one
it.
Of my favorite things to share with people.
I stole the thunder.
Anyway, the traditional rule, for some reason, survivor benefit, you only have to be married 9 months instead of 12. As long as you're married for 9 months, your surviving spouse can then start to receive your full benefit that you were receiving. They'd get nothing if you're not married. But if you die in an accident, as Jim rudely interjected, you don't have to be married the 9 months. You can be, if it's a horrific car accident
nine
on
minutes.
The way home from the wedding.
9 minutes.
And only your spouse passes, you still qualify. A lot of people don't realize that. But if it's a health-related or just aging process or something like that, no, you've got to make it the 9 months. But that is more impactful, I think, if you're wanting to, especially someone who doesn't have anything really for their own Social Security benefit, for whatever reason, your spouse, you know, you made a big deal about you a lifetime of hard work. They might have had a lifetime of hard work just not participating in Social Security, maybe taking care of the previous spouse they had or the household or the kids or who knows what the story is about why. It's not necessarily because they sat around on the couch all day for their entire life that they don't have a Social Security benefit of their own. If that person is not married, now I need to bench this a little bit, that person you're thinking of marrying might actually be eligible for a spousal benefit or survivor benefit from an ex-spouse. So they didn't. He didn't make any mention of that, but that is also a possibility. And you'd want to make sure that you're not overlooking any potential benefits that might be received from that avenue before you get married. So I'll throw that.
But
I'll
let
throw
me
that
throw,
one out there.
Let me throw out a planning strategy then for that, because I was ready to share. Mm-hmm. Follow my logic here and tell me if I was wrong, because I wanted to share something that happened in our office many, many years ago, if you remember, when we were helping a Social Security recipient. So, and this came up with Mary Beth Franklin recently on one of her articles, and she said in her article she hadn't known this. And you and I had figured this out years ago, not because we're brilliant, it just we ran into someone with this problem. But an exception to the one-year rule is if you are entitled to receive a Social Security benefit. And Mary Beth Franklin shared a situation, and I'm thinking in this listener's case, if his wife or soon-to-be wife, maybe wife, is eligible for Social Security benefits due to divorce. She was married for 10 years.
Like we talked before.
And divorced. Mm-hmm. And the ex-spouse is at least 62. He doesn't have to be filing or not. She can file for a benefit under the ex and start receiving that Social Security benefit.
Yep.
Then, the minute you guys marry, because she remarried, she loses her divorced spouse benefit, assuming her ex-spouse isn't dead. We're talking that he's still alive. She would lose that because she hooked her cot to a new horse.
Wow.
What?
You always screw that one up, and you nailed it that time.
I'm getting better.
You can't. Don't try to say it again, because you'll do it backwards. But
I've always said that one right.
Mm-mm. You hook your horse to a new cart, or you do it the other way around.
Oh, well, I'm getting better.
Yeah, no, it's good.
I'm learning.
Sorry
this.
To interrupt. I was just so impressed.
It's on a roll, man.
Yeah.
All right, so follow my logic here, Chris. Mm-hmm. Damn it. I was doing so good. Follow my logic here. If the wife, or soon-to-be wife, was to, before getting married, because we're assuming here, if she was a divorcee, like Chris had said, and eligible for a benefit, and the ex is still alive, or even if he's dead, she could start a widow benefit. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing he has a good size benefit. He had a lifetime of hard work. So now she's collecting, but she remarries. She's going to lose her current divorced benefits. She might lose them the month after. She collected them 1 month and got married. She loses them because she's remarried to someone else. But now the 1 year wait goes away.
Correct.
because they're not going to penalize you for getting married. They're not going to say, oh, sucks for you. You were collecting a Social Security divorce spouse benefit, but you went out, fell in love again, and tried this a second time and went and got married. You lose your Social Security. You got to stay married for 1 year before you can get it.
Right.
Well, Mary Beth Franklin ran into an advisor in that exact situation. Mm. And
we ran into that exact thing.
Yeah, we ran
into
the same thing that we ran into.
As long as, and this is where, believe it or not, in the Social Security Administration vernacular, if you will, being eligible and being entitled to a benefit are two different things. Eligible means you've actually met all the requirements to receive a benefit. You just haven't actually claimed it yet. When you've claimed the benefit, you become entitled. So anytime you are entitled to a benefit, if you then marry, they don't turn you off for the full year. You immediately are entitled again to the new benefits for which you are eligible and can collect the spousal benefit immediately on with the new spouse. Now, but this leads to what I was mentioning before. Maybe her previous horse that she'd attached her cart to,
we'll call him Ed,
has a bigger spousal benefit attached to his record than this person. That might be a reason to not get married right away.
And then she'll just look at you and say, I ain't marrying you.
Yeah, so there's, he didn't mention anything about these exes going on, but you definitely should consider this. Some people, they fall madly in love. They're, you know, they don't think about this. We just had a person, earlier this show, we talked about someone who got divorced after 9 years and 10 months. They clearly didn't consider or couldn't manage that extra 2 months in order to make sure that they could
receive. I fault the attorney on that.
Oh, for sure.
To finalize a divorce 2 months short of the 10-year anniversary.
Right, because there's all kinds of ways you could find a way to delay it.
You just tell the courts, delay this 2 more months before the effective date.
Yeah.
Even Social Security says in that event, you do not have to be living with the person.
No.
You don't have to even be cordial with them or her. You just don't finalize the divorce document until the 10th anniversary.
Correct. So definitely worth pondering and checking out that. And maybe you mentioned that your potential spouse is not currently collecting. Maybe they're actually eligible to collect something and haven't looked into it. Maybe they don't realize that there's this potential benefit from their ex-spouse they could be collecting, and maybe it's better than yours. So there might be some justification for not getting married immediately, if you're going to put that as part of your equation to consider.
Right, because if she even has an ex, we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
But if she does have an ex, but the scenario I described would be if she has an ex, and the ex's benefit is smaller than yours, you're already collecting. So she'll be able to collect. Now, she is working, so we do need to mention that the earnings test until she reaches her full retirement age, again, you don't tell us how old she is, but if she hasn't reached her full retirement age, the earnings test will reduce some of these benefits. Mm-hmm. But outside
only her benefit, only, not his.
Right, not yours, only hers. But once she reaches her full retirement benefit, she's good to go. My point with my strategy is rather than having to wait a year, if she has a spousal benefit from an ex-spouse who she divorced and she was married for at least 10 years to him, she may want to turn that on first, even if it's a tiny amount, and then marry you, and she can switch to her spousal, which is half of your PIA, your full retirement age benefit, right away.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have to wait. Just figured I'd throw that out there.
Yep.
All right. How much time do we have left to do more questions?
Probably zero.
How many minutes have we been recording?
We just went past an hour.
Oh, all right. It's zero. Okay. Well, folks, we got through my math four.
Four. And I told them at the beginning of the show when you weren't paying attention that anything more than three is a success. So we're going to do a applause for a successful show. We actually answered four questions, which is more than three.
Which is more than three. Yeah. Not quite as high as five.
True.
It's kind of like Monty Python.
Very perceptive.
With the holy hand grenade trying to follow the rules. Thou shalt not say three. But we did hit four. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even say three. Okay. So we will see each other. We'll see everyone next week. Actually, no, next week. Damn it. I'm out elk hunting. So we're going to have
on
to.
On what day of the week?
Next week. I leave Sunday.
You're gone the whole week?
I'm gone Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Unless I get the elk, then I will come back. So we'll have to find time to record the next show as well.
So. Yeah. So hopefully there'll be a show next week.
Or there's a lot of Social Security questions.
I could do a cleanup show. That's what I usually do, is try to knock out 6-7 Social Security questions and get caught up on those.
Yeah.
I could always do that.
You'll probably end up doing that because we've got a bunch of Social Security questions you can do.
Okay. So we want to remind everybody, we are living, breathing, practicing retirement planning folks here in Northern Colorado. And I mentioned it, we're financial planners in the broadest sense, but our niche is retirement planning. And if you are interested in talking to us a little bit more about what kind of services we can provide in that area, if you're interested in some help for your retirement planning process.
Because we work with people throughout the United States.
We do.
Make sure you point that out.
Throughout the whole United States. Every state of the union.
I'd go so far as to say we can help you no matter where in the universe you are.
That might be pushing it. Globally. We have global connections.
You don't want to say universe?
The internet kind of stops at the space station, I think.
So E.T. is flying around, coming down here because he heard we're really good with retirement planning, and he wants help, and you're not going to help E.T.?
Well, if he contacts us, we'll do our best. Wow.
Maybe we should phone home.
Yeah. Anyway, if you're somewhere on the globe here and would like some help with your retirement planning, just go to jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you can schedule what we call a coffee and a second opinion, where you can sit down with us face-to-face or virtually, and we can chat about what we do, what your concerns are, what your situation might be, and if it's a good fit, we can move forward into a retirement planning arrangement or relationship. And if we can't help you, we have some unique circumstances, we can try to help you find some resources that can give you a hand with that. But easily done. That's you can schedule the spots right on the calendar app that is on the website, or you can call us the old-fashioned way or email us through that same webpage. So jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And you can learn more about us and reach out to us if it so suits your fancy. So with that, we'll be back with you next week with some sort of show. We'll see, figure out what it is.
Might just be me
solo, but yeah, we'll get through 10, 20 questions on that day.
You may.
Okay. See everybody next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.